Well, good morning. Why don't we go ahead and get started? I think we'll probably still have some folks wandering in trying to manage the elevator banks out there. And for those of you who this is the third time this week you've been here for a CSIS Energy program event, welcome back, and we appreciate your indulgence in coming. We've had a very busy week, but I think many of these topics have been well related. We talked at the beginning of the week with some folks from the IEA who have done their latest energy technology forecasts, which are looking at what the options are for dealing with climate change. Yesterday, Guy Caruso from the EIA was here to talk about their long-run forecast. And then today, we want to take up and begin our session on nuclear energy. So first, I'm David Pumphrey. I'm with the energy program here at CSIS, and many of my colleagues are here in the room as well. Frank Verastro, our director, is here someplace. Frank, where are you? Anyway, energy program has been looking for the past year at the intersection of climate change and energy security, and really looking at the question of how do you make this transition from where we are today with a very high carbon energy system to one that can be a low carbon energy system. How do you make that transition while you're improving energy security overall, maintaining reliability of the energy system, and ensuring that energy costs are at a level that will support continued economic growth? Nuclear energy is clearly one of those options that can contribute to making this transition. And so we thought it would be really important to begin a series of examinations of some of the key questions that nuclear energy is going to face as it looks at this so-called nuclear renaissance. We had a first session last November, sort of an introductory session, and then have now launched onto to this series, and this is the first one of the next series. Of course, nuclear energy is not a new energy source, so this is not like carbon sequestration, which is being held out there as a major solution, but yet has not really been tested, especially at scale. Right now, we have about 20% of our electricity is generated by the 104 operating nuclear reactors. And so this is really a proven technology. So the question is, how do you address the issues and problems that have kept us from approving the construction of a new plant for about 30 years? So throughout the series, we'll start with today's, which is really an overview, to look at what is what we call the space for nuclear in a low-carbon future. And we got a discussion on the numbers and some recent forecasts, which will be in our first panel, looking at the latest technologies and how they have evolved since the technologies that are currently in operation in nuclear plants in the U.S. And then question of what does the public think about nuclear power? Because this is a debate that's going on that, well, the public really doesn't like nuclear power, and I think there's some interesting points that will come out of that. Next month, we're planning to have a session that will look at some of the commercial and business aspects that will be key in ramping up a nuclear power industry, financial issues, supply chain issues, regulatory issues, regulatory capacity questions. And then we'll skip August because we figure no one's going to be here anyway, so probably not us either. But so in September, pick up the question, which is, I think, one of the key questions, which is the back end of the fuel cycle. So what do we do with the waste that's been generated? Do we look at long-term storage? What's the status of that process? And then what about reprocessing? What's the role it can have in a future nuclear industry in the U.S.? And then finally, looking at some of the international aspects, both the growth of nuclear power internationally as well as non-proliferation issues. So that's sort of the layout. I'm going to moderate this morning session to keep it sort of as streamlined as possible. So I'll stay here, so you have to get used to me popping up and down during the three sessions that we'll have. But getting started with our first session, which we call the potential space for nuclear energy, we've got Tom Turbush of the Electric Power Institute and Alan Beeman from the Energy and Information Administration. And most of the biographical information has been provided outside, so I'm not going to go through that. But I think we'll start with Alan, who will give us sort of a what they call a portfolio. No, I'm sorry, Tom. I had it wrong on my sheet. Tom, to give us a portfolio overview and the work that EPRI has been doing recently to look at what are the options, what are the least cost paths towards a clean energy future. And then Alan's going to focus a bit on analysis that EIA had done on the Lieberman-Warner bill and the role for nuclear energy within that. So, Tom, do you want to get started?
Okay. So, hi. How's everybody doing this morning?
Great.
Good. So, starting off with me, what I'm going to do is I'm going to cover, some of you have probably seen EPRI's portfolio work. This is an approach we've been taking for the last couple of years on what's possible technically for the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years out. It's based on modeling we've been doing for 20 or 30 years with INL. But we're going to take a very nuclear-centric look at this today. And we have a lot of modeling we've been doing for the last 3 to 6 months that isn't public yet, which I couldn't actually put in the presentation except for one slide, but we'll talk about what's coming up, and that's going to be published in about a month. So, okay. All right. So just primer for anyone who doesn't know EPRI, I'll spend about 5 minutes covering all the options, and then we'll drill down into nuclear just to give you a framework, because the way EPRI's modeling approach is generally to look at everything, have all the technologies compete, do all these big environmental energy models, and we've done a lot of sensitivity on nuclear, and it's actually extremely positive for nuclear, even if you get into insanely high price ranges just because of, you know, alternatives going forward with carbon constraints. So EPRI is a nonprofit, was founded, 35 years ago by the utilities. We operate in every part of the electricity technology spectrum, basically. So it's from the fuel side all the way through to end-user technologies when it comes to energy efficiency or, you know, just managing load, that sort of thing. So nuclear is one of our biggest areas. I've been working with the nuclear group for about a year. I was at NEI a long, long time ago, and in between that for about 10 years, I was working mostly as chief economist at EPRI on a lot of issues, and nuclear was one of those, but became more and more important, so all of a sudden, I'm in nuclear. So let's see. You know, EPRI, again, very collaborative. We work with most of the U.S. utilities. We work with overseas, with most major utilities overseas, lots of labs. We work with the DOE labs. We work with DOE. We work with a lot of labs overseas. We work with different universities. So most of what we do in collaboration with not just utilities, but in this case, a lot of what we see here, big chunks of it are based on models that we've developed and actually largely funded with INL. So they have to, you know, they have to get a lot of credit for some of the modeling behind this. Not the blame, but the credit. We'll take the blame. What we're going to look at is just for a couple minutes cover technical potential for reducing electric sector CO2 emissions, just all, you know, all across the board, give you a framework with what nuclear is going to have to compete with for the next 20, 30, 40 years. No-brainers, most of you know what that is. We'll look at that. The first thing, a lot of you have seen this, this is the technology, the PRISM from EPRI. It's familiar, you know, a lot of people are taking approaches like that. What would be, how can you slowly work your way down to a certain carbon target, carbon reduction target? Nuclear, in this one, I guess, what is nuclear? Nuclear is yellow, the yellow wedge in here. For those of you who aren't familiar with this sort of approach, this is the CO2 emissions from the electric sector, I guess, here. So you're going, you take a look from the far left, which is 1990, all the way to the future, which was 2030. We're not quite to the middle of that. And so, you know, EPRI was tasked a couple of years ago with, all right, what technologies, given that we see we're probably going to have to, whether we're forced to or not, we're going to have to start being very proactive in managing carbon emissions and trying to get aggressive about reducing these things. What can we do? What can the industry do to start doing that? So there was a number of things. We looked at pretty much every technology that is on the shelf, any sort of different stuff that's not on the shelf yet. What would be feasible by 2030, and where could we get? Each one of these ridges represents a technology. So if you get all of these technologies in play, if you develop them, if you deploy them, theoretically, EPRI projects with our modeling, we could probably get back to about 1990 levels by 2030 if everything went off to plan. And this is really, you know, EPRI sees this as really the maximum of what's possible. And this is if everything goes right, every technology, we're talking energy efficiency, renewables, nuclear, capture and sequestration, a lot of things that are just, you know, you wouldn't really, EIA certainly is not going to be predicting this. I would say. So, and we're not predicting this either. We're saying this is feasible if you start developing a lot of technology now, if you make some deployment decisions now, probably if you have a price on carbon, you could start going in this direction. So this compares, and I guess the latest EIA projection for nuclear is 15 gigawatts of new generation deployed by 2030. We have a projection of about, we think, 64 gigawatts of new generation is certainly feasible, and all of our models suggest it could be more than that, but 64, we're saying, it's a very aggressive target, but we say technically it's feasible. We should be able to develop the technologies, and, you know, the technology is pretty much there, but be able to support this sort of thing with proper carbon pricing, whatever else, and hit that target. Now, that assumes a lot. So that assumes not only that we get to get this sort of carbon reduction that's represented by this yellow wedge here, which means, you know, dropping from the top to the bottom, not only do you get 64 new gigawatts of electricity up, you keep the existing fleet in place. And that's a big assumption, especially when you get past 2030, because, as you know, the first plants start hitting their 60-year license at 2029. And so this is something that EPRI's been doing a lot of sensitivity on and actually doing a lot of work with the utilities and with the labs to look at how do we get existing plants in the U.S. and elsewhere to operate for 100 years, things like this. I mean, people may be a little sensitive about me saying that. But, I mean, we're looking at how do you really manage, how do you really give people the tools so they can start making decisions now about whether to replace and with what or whether they can keep this plant operating for a long time. And if you take a look at some recent projections just in generation mix, you know, right about now nuclear is about 21% of U.S. generation. Depends on the numbers, but somewhere around 20%. I think a recent projection from EIA with the energy bill, you don't know, Alan, if we projected this or you projected this, but it would be about 19% by 2030. With that prism, with 64 new gigawatts of nuclear generation online by 2030, plus the existing fleet still in place, with our modeling, we say it would be about 29%. So you go from 20 or 21% to about 29% with what we regard as technical feasible targets, and this includes all the other possibilities coming on as well. So if those things don't come online, that number probably goes up even higher, depending. So, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So that sort of the technical feasibility piece, I try to run through that really quick so we can sort of drill into some of the assumptions and take a look at different costs and where there might be even more daylight for where the opportunities for nuclear are. There's a huge upside, you know, what's competing with it. So we're moving from this technical feasibility to these economic models where we really just make lots of assumptions, keep changing the assumptions, see how these different technologies play out with each other in the future. One of the most important assumptions is carbon restrictions. So what policy choices, are we going to have a price on carbon? What policy choices are going to be made? And, you know, EPRI has been spending a lot of time not only looking at how those affect the different inputs, what's really feasible. So take a look at this very aggressive technology feasibility that we talked about, which was 64 new gigawatts of nuclear plus we're saying that it's probably technically feasible. We're not promising anything, but if we spend enough money on it to get carbon capture and sequestration online by 2020. Now that's, I mean, well, you're seeing the models. It's a very, the assumption drives a lot of the models. So if you don't have it online, we're, you know, making our carbon restriction targets becomes very difficult and very expensive. So taking a look at it, even assuming the carbon sequestration comes online, captures online, we get 64 new gigawatts of nuclear, huge energy efficient reductions, lots of renewables deployed, and 100 gigawatts of new renewables by 2030, a lot of other very aggressive assumptions. It's still very tough to make some of these targets. So this is looking at the different policy things where in 2010 you start declining. Actually, you cap carbon emissions. You level them off starting in 2010 to 2020, and then they start declining by 3% a year. Pretty aggressive, but given the technology deployment window, that lines up pretty well with those feasibility descriptions that we're taught, that we very aggressive feasibility assumptions we made. If you start declining in 2010, it becomes much more expensive in the short term because you don't have sequestration online. You can't get a nuclear plant built and running by 2010, that sort of thing. So you have to start looking at other things, more expensive renewables, basically price-induced efficiency. People start consuming less because the price goes way up, that sort of thing, and a lot more gas and very expensive natural gas. So one of the first sensitivity analyses we did last year was assuming that doing two worlds where, one, we assume that this full portfolio of options, 100 new gigawatts of renewables, 64 new gigawatts of nuclear, carbon capture and sequestration online by 2020, a lot of other things in other space, including energy efficiency, very ambitious energy efficiency things, targets. Assuming we hit all of that and that's all online by 2020 or even some of those before that, nuclear plants start coming online in the next 6 years, we looked at that and what would be the effect on natural gas prices, on electricity prices, on what price target would nuclear have to hit to, and where would that fall out? And we compare that to what if there is no nuclear. You know, these are just modeling assumptions for sensitivity. What if we don't put any new nuclear online by 2030, what carbon capture and sequestration doesn't come online, and we tamp down some of the aggressive targets of the other ones, but the two most important ones turn out to be coal and nuclear and carbon capture and sequestration for coal. And we compared those two. I'm going to skip this one. What we find in the wholesale electricity price, that the red line is what happens if nuclear doesn't come online at all, and you have no capture and sequestration by 2050 in this case, I believe. You get a price that, on the right side, it's the multiple of the present. So you get a price that's basically 3.5 times the current on the wholesale market by 2050. Even by 2030, it's more than twice what it is now. If you have nuclear online with these aggressive scenarios, if you're able to get the carbon sequestration and capture online, you go up by about 50%, but not quite as much, and it's pretty stable. And so that's one of the first assumptions we made. This is how the fuel mix, the generation mix, shakes out when you make these assumptions. Again, we're assuming the nuclear plants stay online till 2050, which, again, is a big assumption, but the existing fleet, but no new nuclear till 2050 with this assumption. And, again, this is just for modeling. What you find, and coal disappears because you have a hard carbon limit in these models. Coal just can't compete with gas and these other things or price-induced efficiency when it comes to, you have to cut the carbon out of coal. You can't bring new nuclear online, so what happens is you get a lot of gas, which drives the price of electricity very high, and because of that, you get price-induced efficiency, which is this kind of cross the diagonal lines up there. Demand levels off. People just stop. It's like the gasoline prices right now. They just stop consuming. They figure out how to become efficient, this sort of thing. With the full portfolio, meaning that not only everything comes online as we say might be technically feasible, including nuclear, so nuclear becomes quite large, and by 2050, it's a it's a big chunk. I don't remember what the number is, but 35%, 40% of the mix. Coal with the carbon, the lighter blue is with the capture and sequestration. So coal numbers stay pretty flat, but it all turns into capture because you have to do that for carbon limits. Gas starts disappearing. There's that. Let's see. All right. So the other point, I'll skip that one. We'll see. The price of gas goes way up, and what we see is the price of electricity by 2050, just the difference is staggering between having new nuclear and not. And so if you work backwards from that assumption, you can kind of get a sense of where the cost headroom on deploying new plants might be. So right now, maybe we're predicting $2,000 per installed or whatever it was a couple of years ago. We know a lot of that world's changed quite a bit, and these targets keep going up. But with this, in this modeling space, when you do these sensitivities, which we'll talk about in a second, you find it doesn't have to stay at $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 for nuclear to go be very widely deployed. Even with very aggressive assumptions about all the other technologies coming into play, there's still a lot of headroom for nuclear. All right. So another interesting aspect of this, and I'm going to go through this just very quickly, is that what we find, if you have nuclear and capture and sequestration in the mix, the optimal decarbonization, because these models model everything, not just the electricity sector, but all this, every part of worldwide energy, the energy environment sort of matrix, we find that the best path for decarbonization after a certain point is to start electrifying everything. Now, that may sound pretty self-interested coming from EPRI, and I admit that. And we're just, what we see, though, is that the a lot of the heavy lift, depending on the policy, will probably in the 2020 to 2030 range in terms of reducing carbon reductions. A lot of that's probably going to come from the electricity sector because we're, you know, replacing carbon emissions from coal with capture. We're putting nuclear plants online. So all of a sudden, the electricity industry becomes not so carbon intense. And so you start seeing switching out of transportation and other sort of, you know, self-generation, other sorts of things where people start switching into electricity. So, you know, that, and so we had to model that effect because obviously that's also, that affects how much you have to have online. That affects the price. All of a sudden stuff starts electrifying, demand goes up, you have to kind of, so you have to really look at it in a general equilibrium sense and not just assume that the electricity industry is going to be in a standalone silo. And so all those sorts of effects are modeled into this and still very robust for nuclear. These are costs in change in GDP. It was, it maps backwards. If the price of electricity is five times what it is now or whatever, the GDP cost is going to be quite high to not trying to deploy nuclear and carbon capture and sequestration as quickly as possible. And probably spending, you know, even with net present value on money that you're talking about prices 20 years, 25 years from now, it's still substantial when you're talking about that large of a sector of the economy and the amount of money that might be worth spending on deploying new nuclear plants, which means you have a lot of headroom on the cost element for in terms of capital and also developing capture and sequestration, which we have a long ways to go on that, and we need to do that pretty quickly. All right. I'm almost to the end of this. So this is something I pulled out of the recent sensitivity analysis that we've been doing. It's I know this is going to be a little hard to read because I just pulled this off of somebody's email, but basically we were looking at one thing that EPRI's been doing a lot of is not just looking at capital cost assumptions for new plants. We've been looking at how do we keep the existing – we've got this existing set of assets that is carbon – virtually carbon-free. How do we keep these guys running? And because the longer you keep them running, the easier it is in modeling space to – you have more headroom to – you have a little longer to develop carbon sequestration. You don't have to put 120 new nuclear plants online by 2030 to meet targets, or you don't have to reduce consumption to hit these things. So we've been spending a lot of time working with industry slowly and with the labs to look at what would it take to run nuclear plants past 60 years, which is their current license window right now that they're currently relicensed for. And the assumptions are, you know, when you put through these models, you end up with numbers like 90, you know, maybe by 2030 you get it does have an impact. You actually do get more new plants coming online to replace. You get also more gas and you get more coal depending on your assumption. But either way, we can see technically feasible with these models, you might end up with 90 or 100 new gigawatts of nuclear by 2030. Certainly the demand will be there. The question is whether we can deploy that fast. And, you know, if plants start shutting down in 2029, the existing plants, because they hit 60 years, you have to deploy a little bit faster. And there's more, it can even cost a little bit more to do that if it costs money to put more plants online faster. And I think... So some of the – and just, again, the things that we're supposed to be supposedly publishing in another month or so, I believe by the beginning of August, look at what if capital – what if it goes up to $8,000, you know, dollars installed and stuff like that, and you still get a surprising amount of nuclear. Part of the problem is you have carbon restrictions. Those costs are being driven not just by nuclear-specific concerns, by things like concrete and steel and other sorts of things that the alternatives are going to face as well. Other than not consuming, of course, which is an alternative. So you still get a lot of nuclear. So I'm not going to go on here, and maybe I'll let Alan make predictions of what he thinks the price of new nuclear plants will be. But we feel that we haven't heard an estimate from anybody, including folks in Florida, that would forestall nuclear. It's going to, like anything else, you'll get less of it. If the price is high, you'll get less new nuclear, but you'll still probably get a lot of it if you have these sorts of carbon targets in place. And... I think with that, I'll turn it over to David and Alan. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. And that was you did a great job getting through that. We talked to him about doing it in 10 minutes, and you did pretty good, I must admit. We will be putting, assuming that the speakers agree, the presentations up on our website so that you want to go back to them. And I'm sure if you have specific questions, Tom will be glad to address some of the issues he didn't get to do in depth. Next speaker will be Alan Beeman to talk about the EIA analysis on Lieberman Warner and the implications for nuclear power.
Morning. I'm assuming, so some of my slides are really going to provide a lot of background information. I'll assume you'll get a chance to read those when they're all available, so I'll go through some of them pretty quickly. But first, just a little bit of background on EIA and only a couple points to make. We're an independent statistical agency within DOE. We don't make policy or advocate policy, so our analysis and our report shouldn't be seen as the administration, or the Congress, or anyone else's views of policy. I provided here an awful lot of links to various reports that we put out, so that these are all of our reports and all of our analysis are available on our website. All the background details, assumptions are all there. As you're probably familiar, that we put out several energy outlooks, a short-term outlook, our annual energy outlook, and an international energy outlook that Guy Caruso talked about the other day. And we do a lot of service reports. Most of those are requested by Congress, and they asked us to look at what if we propose impose something like Lieberman-Warner and a whole array of other analysis that we've looked at. Just to sort of give you an array, this is just a very small subset of the greenhouse gas analyses that we have done over the last decade or so. I tell people this is my life over the last decade, starting with the Kyoto Protocol in 1998. And as I said, this is just a subset. The most recent one is our analysis of Lieberman-Warner, S2191. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about that today. But all of these are available on the website at the link that I've provided here. So if you have any questions, you can certainly find them there. And all of our contact information is there if you have questions about specific sections. Just to sort of summarize key findings, and I don't think these findings differ across all the studies that I've seen of various proposals to reduce greenhouse gases. It's going to raise energy prices. That's not a shock, I hope, to anyone. The largest emissions reductions generally come from the electric power sector. There's some variance, but they generally do. And then the key options, the mix of the options varies in different studies, but it's using nuclear, renewable, new fossil plants with CCS, greater use of natural gas, particularly if these other technologies, their use is restricted. Offsets, foreign and domestic, they can play a big role, and I'll show those in a little while. And demand-side efficiency gains, particularly in cases where the electricity price impacts are fairly large. Now, what are the key drivers? What really push what the results are going to be in different bills and in response to different bills? Of course, the stringency of the emission limits is a big deal. What sectors are covered? In some of the bills, the residential sector direct emissions are not covered, and some they are. The point of regulation, timing, the rules on banking and borrowing rules in terms of allowances, the treatment of offsets, what degree of offsets. If you allow much freer use of offsets, that tends to keep allowance prices somewhat lower, and then so you have less domestic reductions that have to occur. Is there a safety valve? 2191 doesn't have a safety valve, but Bingaman's bill did have a safety valve. That's certainly a point of contention. I'm sure that's going to go on in continuing negotiations. What do they do with the allowances? Particularly, do they use them for technology to try to spur particular technologies? Both the recent the Lieberman-Warner bill and the Bingaman bill earlier, Bingaman Spector, use a lot of allowances to try to stimulate particular technologies, particularly coal with sequestration. That's a direct competitor with nuclear. So to the degree that they provide additional allowances or additional credits to coal with sequestration, that somewhat dampens the potential market for nuclear. And that's a big issue in terms of how everything plays out. Now, if you look at nuclear specifically, you know, what are the key drivers of what role potentially that nuclear could play? Of course, the cost of new plants is going to play a role, and no, I'm not going to predict the cost of new plants. You will see that my slide has question marks on it where it says the cost of new plants is going to be, but I'll talk about them a little bit. The technology incentives is going to be a big deal, not just for nuclear, but whether they give them to others. And as I mentioned, there seems to be in the last few bills a desire to try to spur coal with capture and sequestration. How fast can you ramp up the construction infrastructure? You know, you hear a lot of talk about people, we haven't built nuclear in a long time. There are A lot of the people that supported that industry decades ago are no longer around, so the industry is going to have to ramp back up. And how fast can that occur? Is the new licensing process going to be a success, or is it going to get bogged down? Demand growth, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. Electricity price and allowance price volatility could potentially be a big issue. For any large capital investment technologies, volatile prices, volatile allowance prices could really make it more difficult to finance and get those plants put in place. The regulatory regime, it's tough to build a big, heavily capital-intensive project in a deregulated market. It's a risky business. They take a long time to build. You have to trying to project out what prices you might face gets really difficult. The waste disposal issue, and there's going to be people talking about it later, but that's a big issue. It certainly affects the perception of where nuclear can go and whether the public will accept it. Now, looking at cost, and as you can see at the very bottom, I did put question marks. We didn't coordinate here.
But can't see the bottom.
But if you look back, and we looked back at what the previous generation of nuclear plants cost, you know, from those ones built, you know, in the 80s to 2000, and if you take off the financing cost and back everything out, they come in somewhere around $4,000 a kilowatt. Now, a lot of these were delayed a long time, and we didn't include financing. A lot of them were had a lot of backfits and refits and changes, so that they were pretty expensive. In 2002, we were trying to put together our cost assumptions for nuclear, and we met with many of the vendors and representatives of all the different vendors that are going to speak today. And they made convincing arguments that the next generation of nuclear power plants will be much simpler. They will be the designs have been much more thoroughly completed before they get into the construction phase. They're tried to rationalize the way they put them together to reduce a lot of redundancies, and that they were arguing for costs somewhere in this range of $1,200 to $1,500 a kilowatt. We were not quite ready to go to that level. We didn't think that was likely. Vendors normally, in advance of a technology, tend to underestimate the costs. And so we went with costs in a little over $2,000 a kilowatt. Now, some of you are probably familiar with the MIT study, The Future of Nuclear. They put costs in the same range. They said $2,000. But optimistically, if things all went right, they could possibly hit the 1,500 level. Now, recently, the Keystone Center did a fact-finding study, and they came out right around 3,000. They actually did 2,950. You can see here I rounded everything to 100 because I just don't believe any. If anybody can get to the $10 range, they've been way better than me. So around $3,000. In our 2007 AEO, we had about $2,100. We increased them to reflect price increases in 2008, around $2,500. Now, if you look at the Florida, people talked about the Florida docket. They recently put out, and they listed a whole sets of them. They had a high and low cases and existing greenfield or brownfield units or greenfield units. They had a range of around $2,900 to $5,100 a kilowatt. And so in our Lieber and Warner analysis, we did a couple cases, one where we started with a reference cost of $2,500 and one where we increased that by 50% to $3,700. What do they cost today is what the latest estimates. You can't go a week reading the energy rags now and not see a higher cost for almost everything, but nuclear in particular. So you couldn't fill this number in. You'd have to keep changing it daily, and so that would be tough. On issue of demand, everybody keeps talking about electricity demand is growing. That's true, but it's slowing, and it has been for decades. Now, this is a particularly big issue for all the big technologies. You know, it's hard to bring – nuclear doesn't come small. So, you know, you can't bring it on in 100-megawatt increments. You bring it on at 1,500-megawatt increments or more. So when your demand for electricity is only growing at 1% or so, as you can see here, it was 9% in the 50s, down to 7, down to 4, and in the early parts of this decade, it's been barely over 1, and our forecast is for continue at that rate of about 1. When you bring on a nuclear plant, you're probably going to put yourself, for a while, in somewhat of an overcapacity situation. And that creates an issue. You can't bring it on in little teeny pieces, so it makes it hard to deal with big additions like that. Not just nuclear, but coal's somewhat smaller, but it has that similar issue. Now, I'm going to talk now about Lieberman Warner. And I'm not going to give you all the details here, only to point out a couple things. You're talking about reductions of about 39% below 2006 levels by 2030. So it's fairly stringent, and it goes down to roughly 70% below by 2050. So it does get pretty stringent in the out years. I'll let you all look at this later. The only thing I'd want to point out is the very bottom 2 points. Lieberman-Warner doesn't have a safety valve, and it doesn't. There were several provisions in the bill that we didn't analyze. We didn't analyze the. They had some provisions in there to give allowances to new entrant fossil plants. We didn't capture that. We also didn't do the low-carbon transportation standard, and so that's can in the transportation sector that can be fairly significant. So you should be aware of that. I'm going to spend a few minutes here just so through the rest of the talk you can understand what the cases are. Of course, we started with a reference case. In our core case, we basically said there's no barriers. You can build as much of each one of the technologies as you want. You can. Nothing limits it. It used our reference case costs. We did represent the bonus allowances to CCS and other technologies. Then we did one where we said, but you can't use international offsets. So that's the no international offsets case, and I'll show you what that does. We did the high cost case. As I mentioned, we did one where we assumed the costs are 50% higher. We did a limited alternatives where we basically said that CCS, nuclear, and LNG imports are limited to the reference case levels. You just can't push them beyond that. And what does that do to allowance prices and to the compliance options? And then we did one combining all of those limitations. The final one here on the bottom is we did do an update of 1766 that we had done earlier, and I just mentioned that on a slide or two, not very much. Here is the range of allowance prices. You know, if you look at the very bottom line, I guess that's sort of purplish. That's 1766. Now you notice it's much lower allowance prices than the other than Lieberman Warner, and the reason for that is it does have a safety valve. In their bill, it's referred to as a technology accelerator payment because the idea is that payments into that, if you people take advantage of that provision, that money that's collected through that will be used to try to accelerate technology development, and so it ends up being around $25 in 2030. Then the next one up is the core case. You don't have any restrictions. You can build everything, as much nuclear as you want, much CCS if it's, you know, it just depends on the economics. And that runs into about $60 by 2030. Then you see several cases that sort of join together in that $80 to $90 range. And then the very upper case, that's the where all these things are limited fairly severely. You can't build up beyond about 15, 17 gigawatts of nuclear. Coal with CCS just isn't commercially available by then, and the international offsets are limited. Now you're pushing the allowance price up to 160. And why does that happen? Because if those things aren't there and you can't decarbonize the power sector as heavily, you have to push the allowance prices up pretty high before you push demand down in response in other sectors. So what happens with these sorts of prices? Energy prices go up. And if you look in the upper left-hand panel, you can see these are coal prices. Now, two things to note, the lower blue section, that's the coal price without allowance prices. It actually goes down because you're not using as much coal. But when you add in the cost, if you had to buy allowances to cover any emissions associated with using that coal, coal prices can go up anywhere between 400 and 800% in these different cases. The delivered price on natural gas, now if you go to the panel on the lower left, it has similar, it doesn't, you know, because it's not as carbon intensive, so the allowance price doesn't have as big an impact. But the one thing to note there is if you can build all the nuclear you want, all the CCS you want, gas use actually goes down a little bit, and the gas price without the allowance fee goes down. On the other hand, as you move out to the right where those things are more limited, your use of gas goes up because you use it instead of coal, and both the allowance price and the price of the underlying gas goes up. So it's pretty significant. Now if you look to the upper right-hand panel, this is motor gasoline prices. The one thing to note is motor gasoline, it's sort of a general rule of thumb, for every dollar in the allowance price, motor gasoline prices goes up pretty close, $50 on the price, about a little under 50 cents on the motor gasoline price. So it has to get pretty big before you have a real big impact. So you can see in most of these cases, it's in this range of 40 to 50 cents, except when you get to the most limited case where the allowance price is $160, and so now you're up over a dollar, and it has a significant impact. But it's one reason why you don't typically see huge reductions in the transportation sector. We've all seen how much the price of gasoline has gone up now. Yes, people are low in it, but it's gone up now in the last 2 years more than it goes up in these cases. So it's a point to keep in mind there. Now, these pictures sort of show you the mix of compliance. I should have turned these things up, made them negative, because what they're showing you is the reductions. So keep that in mind. It's showing you where the reductions are coming from. They're really negative. The big thing to see is the dark blue section. That's the energy-related CO2 emissions. The two bottom sections, dark blue and the light blue, are what comes out of the energy sector. And you can see it dominates in all the cases. The red section is offsets. If you allow them, they play an important role, particularly early, because they tend to be fairly inexpensive. And so they're able to purchase lower cost offsets early on, and you have time to bring on technologies later. But if they're not there, then the allowance prices end up being a lot higher, particularly early, because you have to raise prices higher to drive down demand to meet the caps. So those are just the points that I wanted to make about those. So where does the CO2 emissions reductions come from? Hopefully it's pretty clear to you. If you look at the light blue sections, the bottom pieces, that's the power sector. So you can see in our reference case, it would grow up to a little under 3,000 million metric tons. Now you can see what happens to that in all of those cases. If you have the core, if you're allowed to build as much nuclear and everything else as you would want, depending on the economics, the power sector goes down pretty dramatically. If they're restricted, as you move out to the right, you see that it still goes down quite a bit, but not as much as under the other cases. Now, all the other sectors, transportation, industrial, and buildings, they also go down, but nowhere near to the degree that the power sector does. Now you look at the generation by fuel, and you can see that absent any sort of concerns about climate change and any greenhouse gas limitations, we would expect to see a big growth in coal. That's what shows in the reference case. But if climate change legislation is passed and there's a requirement to reduce greenhouse gases, coal gets prohibitively expensive to continue to use without CCS, and you see dramatic reductions in coal. And you see that offsets by increases in nuclear renewables. And as you move to the right, as you're restricting the use of nuclear or coal with CCS, you see a bigger role played by natural gas and a bigger role played by renewables, because if without those options, you're going to have to turn to natural gas and renewables, and they become more and more important. Of course, that gets more and more expensive. The other thing to note, too, is notice how the overall generation drops as you move to the right. As that allowance price keeps pushing up higher and higher and the electricity price gets higher and higher, price-induced efficiency gets higher. As I said, our reference case has demand growth about 1.1%, 1.2%. In the most limited case, the farthest to the right, electricity demand has now only grown 0.6% per year, so it's essentially cut in half. Slower than population growth, it's a fairly significant reduction. Now, what sort of capacity mix are you building? Two things to note in this slide. First, just ignore the mix. Look at how much you're building in the reference case, something on the order of 260, 270 gigawatts of capacity. You're nearly doubling that in most of the Lieberman-Warner cases. And the reason for that is you have to build capacity not only to meet demand growth, but to replace this coal capacity that you're not going to be using anymore. Now, it's possible some of this would be retrofits. A few years ago, most people were sort of dismissing the idea of retrofitting existing coal plants with CCS, but a lot of companies are trying to pursue that now, and perhaps they'll be successful. Some of that might be. But the point is you're going to have to build a lot, so there's going to be a huge amount of investment in the power sector. Whether it's retrofits or totally new plants, it'll be significant. But then if you look at the mix, you can see if there's no restrictions, the economics tend to favor – nuclear. In our analyses, generally nuclear comes in before coal with CCS would. If you can see when we, in the high cost case where we assume it's 50% higher, we did that for nuclear and coal with CCS. Nuclear is dramatically lower, but it's still big, still 88 gigawatts. As Tom mentioned, you know, even at fairly high cost, it plays an important role because the other technology, the issue is going to be relative costs. If nuclear doubles and everybody else doesn't, then maybe it won't play as much a role, but it looks now like everything's going up, so it's going to be important to see what the relative costs are. But the thing to notice as you move to the right again is if these options aren't available, coal with CCS or nuclear, or they're a lot more expensive, then you start depending more and more heavily on natural gas and on renewables. And so that becomes a really big deal because you put pressure on the natural gas market and natural gas prices. And this is last slide. I just wanted to, you know, how fast can you ramp up the nuclear industry? First thing, look at the black line. What I did here was I took from the beginning of the construction of nuclear power, how as you ramped up how many plants were under construction. That black line is what we did starting from the early construction periods in the 1960s. So over about from 0 year to 10, 12 years, we ramped up to building on having about 80 gigawatts under construction. Now you can see in that in the core case where we said you could build as much as you want, it rapidly outpaces that rate of increase. But in the high cost case, the green line, you can see that we're not anywhere near ramping up as fast as we did back in the early 60s. So it sort of says, well, and one thing to remember about the historical number, there were another 150 gigawatts of nuclear that had received their construction licenses, but then were eventually canceled. So how fast can they ramp up? That's a big question. There's an awful lot of off-roads where things could go wrong. But it certainly seems that there's certainly a window of opportunity under a greenhouse restricted environment to build new nuclear. I think for me, the biggest issue is the first ones better come in pretty close to cost and times that people expect them to, because while the window's open, somebody's still got their hand on top of it. And if those things don't happen, it could get slammed shut really quick, and that would be a big issue. With that, there's my contact information if you have questions or want to get a hold of me. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Alan. It was a great presentation on providing a range. So we really have, I think, a conclusion here, which is, and this is probably not great insight, but if we're looking for the least cost pathway to a low-carbon future, nuclear energy has a potential to play a very important role. I would like to perhaps develop a little further, if you could, Tom and Alan, the difference between Tom's portfolio analysis, which is talking about, 64 gigawatts new capacity, and then how does that differ from Alan's 268 gigawatts, which I think is more the potential. But perhaps you'd like to speak on that, and then we'll have time to take a couple questions.
Well, I can start.
I don't know if this. Yeah. For the 64, we at the time certainly we thought that's pretty aggressive, and those are not necessarily. We did not back that number out from what the cost of electricity was going to be, what the cost of carbon was going to be. This was really industry consensus, working with vendors on what they really thought was feasible in terms of deployment. And as Alan said, it's that first period, the next 6 years, that's pretty critical for an industry. If they come in on time, if there's no problems, if everything really ramps up correctly, you could get certainly far beyond 64. The industry consensus and with vendors, I believe, at least when we, a year ago, was the next, until 2020, there's only so much we probably can do. After 2020, if everything goes well until that time, you could probably get far beyond 64. 268 seems very aggressive, but we're talking about 12 years from now just to get to 2020. I mean, who knows what's going to be happening 12 years from now? So we don't know what the carbon thing is. but we feel that you certainly, going over 100 gigawatts by 2030 would be completely plausible, but we're trying to make it apples to apples with all these other technology jumps.
I would agree. The core case numbers without any limits on the infrastructure or anything like that, I don't think they're very likely. But one of the hardest things to do as somebody who's been in the projection business a long time is trying to project the future when you're instituting some policy that just basically flips the industry on its head. When we see $50, $60, $80, $100 potentially carbon fees, that just completely changes the economics in the power business. And so everybody tends to what you can really be guilty of in forecasting projection business is thinking back about 3 years and thinking that's how the future is going to go. But we're really changing that whole picture. So I think it's really unclear, and I completely agree with Tom that the issue is, though, as I said, that window's open. If those first 3, 4, or 5 plants come in and are built with relative, there's not huge licensing debates that hold things up. They come in somewhat close to cost and operate without problems, then I could see you having a pretty bright future. We're already starting to see, and others I'm sure could fill in more than that, there's a huge growth in people going into nuclear engineering. The industries are starting to ramp back up. I think the big uncertainty is everybody's sort of waiting for you got to put that policy in place, and then they'll really commit to it. They're not going to, nobody's going to throw – these are billions. One thing to understand is all the investments in these technologies, we're talking billions of dollars in the investments, not millions. And so nobody's going to pull the trigger on those sorts of investments until they're pretty confident policy is going to go forward. If I were a big investor in this industry right now, I'd have a huge incentive to want to wait until everything's I could see what the landscape's going to look like. And I think that really, is sort of the position people are in right now, pulling the trigger on a multi-billion dollar investment. As I remember one CEO executive saying that that's betting the company. And so I think that's a big deal.
Great. I think we got time for a couple of questions. So we have some questions here on the side. And then the second one will be?
I'm Leonard Oberlander, a consultant. My question is that compared with the countries that have had the most experience in the last decade, at least much less 30 years, Russia and France, in nuclear power, Where does the U.S. get the financing, the experienced personnel, and the state-of-the-art materials? And how do American entities compete domestically with French and Russian nuclear power technology export capability?
Well, the vendors.
Yeah, I think you might want to ask the next group of folks on that. I can't speak for Alan, but anything for at this, I would be conjecturing about as much as anybody else on that. I think probably either the vendors or if you actually had somebody from industry that was looking at the problems of who they get in. I would just say that if you look at who's working, which our utilities right now in the U.S. that are working with vendors. It's a predominance of, depending if you count Westinghouse as a U.S. vendor or not, depending on their ownership, but it's a predominance of U.S.-based vendors that are actually working closely with utilities. And Areva will get in there. I don't know about the Russians, but we might have somebody in the audience who's more knowledgeable about that.
Briefly responsible.
I'm Andy Cook. I'm with Areva. We're the largest supplier of nuclear fuel equipment and services in the United States, even though we're owned by a Paris-based company. So we're also an American company with 5,000 employees. E.ON, RWE, major international utilities want to play in the U.S. They want to put money in here. So does EDF. We have banks who want to bring money here right now. We have international sources of supply of raw material. It's there. I was brief.
That was brief, but you get another you get another shot in just a second. So, in the back there, and then on the side, be second.
Tom, your scenario of 64 gigawatts really is not aggressive. I mean, we brought on from 1971 to 1983 5 gigawatt electric per year in nuclear, and Allen's data, if you look at those slopes, that's pretty much what it will show. But is the industry's perspective sort of constrained by the limited availability of steel manufacturing, you know, heavy forgings? Because right now there's Japan Steelworks in Doosan. So is your scenario pretty much limited and based on the fact that there's going to be, you know, a limited supply of those kinds of components? And I know Areva is going to raise their hand and say, we're going to develop that capability in the U.S., but right now the major suppliers are Japan. So I would like to get your feedback on that.
Sure. I mean, I think in the near term, yes. And I would say that just, you know, it's very hard for whether it's utilities or anyone to imagine much beyond 10 years from now. And certainly in the next 10 years, because of some of the situations, we're much more constrained than we may be from the 2020 to 2030 period. That's what we would say. So I would agree with you. 64 gigawatts is it's not nearly as aggressive as one could get, because you can't predict the future. If the price of electricity goes way up, the price of carbon goes way up, it's not impossible to have 268, and certainly the industry will adapt, and you'll price signals, people will start, you'll have forging companies all over the place trying to do this within 10 or 12 years. You can imagine that would be possible. So part of it is just kind of a natural myopia, and maybe a conservatism on, you know, the next 10 years, we know we're much more constrained than we'll be the next 10 years, and so you're a lot safer making a 2020 estimate than 2030, and also EPRI's a little constrained, and we're trying to make apples to apples comparisons across all the industries and you know, all the different type of fuel types. So we're trying not to push all the fuel types out of the model. And part of it, at least from EPRI's point of view, is when it comes to carbon capture and sequestration, which is a much heavier lift than building 100 new gigawatts of nuclear, and we appreciate that. Electricity prices get very expensive. I mean, you need to build a lot of nuclear And even in the U.S., even if we were able to go completely nuclear in the U.S., what about China if we don't develop carbon capture and sequestration? It's just that we feel that it's in the public interest to work on these things, and also we'll keep the price of electricity cheaper. I mean, nuclear is – you can't just have nuclear, and although it could happen.
I mean, the only thing I would say is people don't realize that nothing moves, you know, relative to a lot of other technologies – things just don't move as fast with nuclear. There's a huge regulatory infrastructure. There's a huge, when somebody opens a new nuclear facility, they've got to get all the approvals, all that. It's not, we built 60 gigawatts of combined cycle in the United States and combined cycle and turbines in 2002. So people can build a lot of capacity. You can build a lot of capacity. You can connect a lot of capacity to the grid. We built that in 1 year, but there's a big, big difference between building and ramping up nuclear. So these are big, big projects. There's going to be some – that start gate is going to take some time. It's that next 10 years after that first 10 that's, you know, how far can you really go with it is the real issue.
Okay, we'll take one more question for this panel, and then we'll have to move on.
Tom Cochran from NRDC. Tom, EPRI doesn't have a stellar record at projecting – nuclear growth in this country, and all these models don't give you very accurate results because of you don't know what the input assumptions are, and I would behoove you to stick to sensitivity analysis rather than trying to make projections. But I would be curious what you assume for the cost of nuclear power plants, like the levelized cost, so we can compare it with the EIA slide. And secondly, it seems to me, rather than try to project these kinds of numbers, the real issue is, do you have the policy right? And if you're going to control carbon, I mean, if you're going to control climate mitigation, you need to cap carbon and then let everybody compete. And I'm less concerned about what the mix is as opposed to what the policy is. And I'm curious whether EPRI is for some sort of GOS plan where you fix the number of nuclear plants you want to have and then go out and subsidize them, because the number of nuclear plants we're going to build, at least in the near term, is the number that the Congress is willing to heavily subsidize, and I think that's the wrong policy. The subsidies have not lowered the cost of nuclear plants. The plants have gone up as the subsidies have gone up.
Well, you know, that's a good point. I mean, first I want to caveat it. I mean, EPRI is not in the projection business, but EPRI does we do research. We need to know what to research. We're putting a lot of money, more and more, in energy efficiency, and we're trying to figure out how to enable renewables. There's a lot of money already going into renewables. So when it comes to nuclear power, we're not trying to make projections, but we're trying to make sure that we at least have the research in place to support what may happen. I mean, this is – and again, I'll see, you know, EPRI's – unlike NRDC, we're really not allowed to get into the policy debate nearly as much. We can try to support it with what technologies we see may be possible. And we see a lot – we see a ton of opportunity for – in the energy efficiency areas, in the renewables areas, in nuclear area, in coal, which is one of the heavier lifts again, but there's sort of a necessity to do something to keep the price of electricity down, we think. So when it comes to nuclear – you're right. I mean, all this modeling is pretty much based on assumptions. When it comes to the price forecast, the one we used for the last year, I think, was about 3,000. But our sensitivities, we've taken up to about 10,000. And we're finding it has much less impact than what we forecast, than what you might imagine on the nuclear adoption rate, deployment rate. But part of that is doing a decomposition of what's driving that nuclear number. So if nuclear price goes up to $10,000, what is the coal price doing? What is the and what does that affect? So if it's just steel and concrete, if there's a particular regulatory concern that's driving that up to $10,000, then you see a lot less nuclear. But, you know, again, we don't know that. And I would agree with you, it's very important to get the policy right. EPRI's only job here is we're trying to just make sure that we're prepared to do the research to give policymakers as many options as possible. So we're trying, you know, we would just advocate that we think it's in, you know, instead of giving policymakers a fait accompli where they can only do nuclear or they could only do energy efficiency, let's try to develop as many technologies as possible to give maximum flexibility. And it's like any good portfolio, the more options you have, in the long run, probably the better return you get. In this case, it's cheaper electricity for the American people.
Well, join me in thanking the panel for an excellent set of presentations. Great. Thanks, guys. We'll now take just a couple minutes to reset and bring our next panel up, so it might be a good chance to grab some coffee. Okay, well, let's go ahead and get started on our second panel, because I think that there's a lot of material to cover in this second panel. We wanted to do this, as we mentioned earlier, this review of the state of the art of the current technology that's being deployed into the marketplace. It's not being built in the U.S., obviously, but it is starting to appear in other countries. And this is the so-called Generation 3 technologies, which has been moving forward and claims to have serious and important advantages in cost as well as safety. So we thought it would be a great opportunity to review this briefly and have some of the different vendors present their best case for their technologies. Now, we seem to have lost one of our speakers. But at any rate, he's the third speaker, so we'll hope that Lee gets here. First speaker, and who's already had a shot at presentation, so hopefully he will give some of his time then to his colleagues, is Andrew Cook from Areva. And who will talk about their EPR. Second will be Ed Cummings, Westinghouse. I think we'll focus on the AP1000. And then Lee Elder will focus on GE's, I assume it's the ES PWR. But at any rate, Andrew, if you want to get started.
Okay. Thanks, David. If anybody can't hear me, just raise your hand and we'll hop right to it. I want to talk about certainty for uncertain times. And we've been talking today about the uncertain times the world is in and the nation is in, both in terms of carbon dioxide, fuel prices, and energy in aggregate. And our whole discussion here is going to be about creating certainty in uncertain times. The whole process that I'm going to be talking about is an old process. Nuclear fission was discovered in 1938. This stuff is older than I am. And the fuel that's used for nuclear power reactors, that pellet, and here is one of those pellets, is equivalent to 148 gallons of oil, a ton of coal, or 17,000 cubic feet of natural gas. This pellet, okay, which has been in use basically for 50 years, and does not emit carbon dioxide when you use it, and it is a solid, it is a rock, and when you're done with it, it's right there. It's not in the air that you and I breathe. It is exactly in the reactor in safe storage. How we use that fuel, me and both my competitors, Hitachi, General Electric, and Toshiba Westinghouse, the way we use it is a technology that's also been around for 50 years and is very basic and extremely well known, which is generate heat with this rock nuclear fuel, turn the heat into steam in a closed loop, use that closed loop to run a turbine and generate electricity. This isn't rocket science. I'm 57 years old. This stuff is almost as old as me. This is our new plant. Now, this is a new evolutionary version of that existing technology. And if you look at it, you'd say, but Andy, that looks like what you just showed me. There's a nuclear reactor. There are the steam generators. There's the turbine. It's the same thing. What's new and different to make it safer and more economical, and one of the certain things to help us in the future, and we're going to be talking about that. My company, Areva, is dedicated to delivering certainty to the United States and to the world. And we're investing to provide that certainty for the future, for the long-range future, which means, for example, we have acquired Uramin for $2.6 billion. We just signed an agreement with Kazakhstan for mines. We're building a new enrichment plant in Idaho. We're building another enrichment plant in France, centrifuge enrichment plant. We have built nuclear fuel reprocessing facilities. We're building a new heavy component manufacturing facility in the United States. We bought a large forge company. We are making the investments to provide the resources to turn out on the order of 50 new nuclear power plants in operation by the year 2030. That we are making the investment. What's our company all about? If you add up the nuclear revenues of different companies around the world, GE, Hitachi, Toshiba, Westinghouse, Areva, we're the major player. We are a single play player in nuclear power. Our whole fate is linked to the success of nuclear power. And we're not in this business for 5 years or 50 years. We're in this business for 400 years. Because if you think about it, there is no energy source that humans have discovered that they have ever abandoned. There is none. Whether it's muscle power, horsepower, dog power, hydropower, wind power, whatever it is, every one of those energy sources we continue to use today. And for sure, 400 years from today, the humans will be continuing to use nuclear power, and we're going to be there, and we're going to be part of it. We're the largest single supplier of nuclear fuel services and equipment in the United States, bar none. Bar none. We have over 5,000 employees right here in the United States. We are a U.S. supplier. We fabricate nuclear fuel here. I'm going to be talking about our EPR, Evolutionary Power Reactor, and it has the right mix. It's a Generation 3 plus design. That means it meets the DOE's criterion for a new plant in 2010 with advanced safety features. It is that design, and it has the right mix of passive and active features. And what does that mean, right mix? Well, you have passive safety features in your car, which are an airbag. You don't want to use the airbag. If your airbag activates in an accident, then you're going to take that thing into the shop for $500 or $600 to get it fixed, and it's going to be out of service. You want active safety features, too. You want a brake. You want a steering wheel so that you can react quickly, not after the accident has occurred, take diversionary action, and bring your unit, which is your car, back into control, and then continue on down the road. And that's the kind of plant that we are offering and, in fact, are building. It's the right mix of passive features and active features that operators actually want. Areva has a track record of building exact standard plants, not plants that change unit to unit, as was done in the United States. Exact standard plants. 34 900 megawatt units, exact replicas. Another 11 around the world. 20 1300 megawatt plants, exact replicas. Four 1500 megawatt plants, exact replicas. That is our legacy, and that is why France is so successfully producing 85% of its electricity with nuclear non-carbon dioxide emitting electricity. These are some of our beautiful plants. This one. There's another one, 1,300 megawatts. There's one of our beautiful 1,500 megawatt units. Our EPR is 1,650. It's only 150 megawatts bigger than this unit, which is in operation along with its three sisters. Oh, there's another one we built in Belgium. Those are two replicas that we built in South Africa and that are running. Here's another one, another pair, beautiful pair, non-carbon dioxide emitting in Korea. Four more in China, and they've got another four in construction. And we've never stopped construction. There was a question about availability of materials and resources. We've been in the business and building while the United States has been waiting, continuously doing that. This follows exactly the trajectory we were following, and you'll see the N4s at 1,500. We're up at 1,650, and look at, there are two units being built right now. We are developing the certainty to supply these nuclear units in a time of uncertainty when people need the plants. Our new plant, our EPR Gen 3 Plus type plant, with the right mix of passive and active features, is based on the Areva N4 type design, which exists, four of them in France, and the Siemens Convoy type designs. And with a member, 10 operating utilities helped us to design it to decide the right features to put in it. And these are some of the features: reduced occupational exposure, radiation exposure, increased design margin, increased redundancy. We're going to talk about this. Reduced core damage frequency. The operating plants today are very safe in the United States. The vendors have done a great job. The NRC has done a great job. Our plant is yet another factor of 100 safer than that, even though the ones today are more than safe. We also accommodate severe accidents with no hazard for the local population, and we're reducing generation costs and fuel costs by at least 10%. Oh, someone asked about waste. If you have nuclear fuel today and you've burned it and you want it to be reprocessed and put back in your plant and burn, I will do it today. Come and see me right after this, and I will sign a contract. We do it. We have two plants that do it. We have built over 1,000 nuclear fuel assemblies of plutonium-bearing fuel and burned them in commercial nuclear power plants. This is not rocket science. It is based on American technology. We do it. We do it commercially. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the plant. This is our beautiful plant. If you look at it, it has four independent safety trains. It would be like having a car with four independent brake systems or four independent steering wheels. Two of those are hardened against direct impact by a large commercial airliner, which I'm going to show you. You can have one out of service. One can fail, one can be hit by an airplane, and one is sufficient to keep the plant in safe shutdown. Not counting that, we also have double wall containment building, which is designed so we do not have to have active core spray safety systems to keep the thing cool. We can actually handle an overpressurization event just like that. And we have included water rating containment. You can actually see it in blue. So in the event that you need reserve water in the event of an accident, it's there. It's borated. It's right there for you. So this is the aircraft hazard protection you will notice in this containment building. You may not see it. There is a 3-inch thick steel liner. Then there is a 3.5-foot thick concrete building to keep the radiation in and pressure. Then there is a 4.5-foot thick concrete building to keep airplanes and other undesirable things out. Wow. I mean, belt and suspenders and another belt and two more pairs of pants. What are we talking about here? And there's the very thing. Now, that is providing certainty to you and I and to the public and to the regulators that these plants are going to be there and continue the excellent track record that has occurred with the existing units throughout the United States. Whoa. There's a picture from our actual engineering analysis. We are actually doing the impact analysis, and we have done it, and committed it and submitted it in our licensing document to the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission for this very incredible event. It speaks for itself. Not only is the reactor protected from this event, but the safety train is protected against this event. We have based the licensing on what we're doing in Finland and France. By the way, it's being licensed in Finland in process. It's been licensed in plant. In France, we have readjusted the analysis to be in compliance with ASME and NRC codes and regulations and have submitted our licensing documents to the US NRC. They like it. The reason why they like the US EPR is because it looks like other plants they have seen. There is nothing overly radically new. This thing really will work because it looks like what we already have but upgraded. The NRC is very comfortable with it. They have accepted a design certification documentation. It's under review, and we expect to be licensed by May of 2011. Well, We're creating real plants now. These are not hypothetical paper Gen 3 type plants that I could wave my sales hands about. I'm the vice president of sales and marketing, senior vice president, but I wanted to establish a little credibility. I have a PhD from MIT in nuclear engineering, and I actually did design nuclear reactor fuel. But in spite of that, I am in sales, and we are actually building these real things. So there's one we're building in probably the greenest country in the world, Finland. It was picked in a competitive analysis. We competed against GE Hitachi. We competed against the Russians. We won this job. That's its current status today. I highly recommend that you go and visit. Have a sauna, swim in the Baltic, and we're actually building the turbine building. Here's the one we're building in Flamanville, about 10 miles from our nuclear fuel reprocessing plant in La Hague, which is all of 30 miles from the Normandy beaches. You've got to go. You can see Normandy. You can see how we process fuel and get plutonium and put it back in fuel, and you can see our beautiful EPR under construction, like it's starting to be constructed in China. There it is. And like these people who are giving serious consideration to this alternative, all of these people are giving serious consideration. Now, why is everybody giving serious consideration all around the world to nuclear power plants? Why are they doing that? It's not a question of, well, should we have nuclear power or solar or wind or geothermal or one of those against the other? The situation of our collective consumption around the world of carbon-bearing fuels is overwhelming. Overwhelming. 85% of all of our energy around the world is coming from carbon-bearing fuel. And there's two big problems. People like me won't die, and our kids are falling in love. And the result is the population is growing and growing. And then people like the Chinese actually think they want to have the lifestyle that you and I have. So they want to increase their energy consumption by a factor of 10. That's how much they are behind the energy consumption of every single person in this room. The situation is overwhelming. In these uncertain times, when energy prices are zooming, coal prices are zooming, natural gas prices are zooming, oil prices are zooming because these other people want them, they want them, we have nuclear power available to us in these uncertain times. I read a book once called Little Eyes Upon You, and it's about your children watching you. So you have to watch your behaviors because they're watching you. Well, little eyes are upon all of us on the decisions we make and are making in the United States and around the world today. But they're not our children. They're not our grandchildren. They're our great-great-grandchildren. And we'll never meet them. We may never meet them. But I am confident we are going to make the right choices, and they're going to have good reason to thank all of us, everyone in the room, for the choices we're making. When you head into a crisis, you don't want to play around with experimental designs. You don't want to play around with unproven designs. You don't want to play around with paper designs. You want something when you're going into a crisis that you know will work. This is my beautiful plant. This is Areva's EPR, certainty for uncertain times. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andy. Now, can you remind me which section of Areva you now work with? Our next speaker will be Ed Cummings from Westinghouse. Is it Westinghouse Toshiba, or just go by Westinghouse?
Westinghouse is fine.
That's what I thought.
Okay, I'm Ed Cummins, and Jesus, where's the contract? I'm going to talk a little bit about Westinghouse and our AP1000. This is a picture of the AP1000. It's an 1,100-megawatt plant. It's a pressurized water reactor, just like Areva's pressurized water reactor. It's a two-loop plant with two steam generators and four reactor coolant pumps. Our customers are very conservative folks. They really are not in the business of taking technology risk. And so one important thing for them is that you have a proven basis for your plant. And the AP1000 works exactly like, for its power generation function, exactly like every plant that's, every pressurized water reactor that's operating in the U.S. today. That's about 60% of them. And it has the same kind of fuel and the same kind of pumps and the same kind of steam generators and the same kind of control system. The difference between the AP1000 and the plants that are operating in today is what happens in design basis accidents. That's when something goes wrong with the plant. And in our case, we have simplified the safety of the plant to be reliant on passive systems. Passive meaning no AC power. And if you can take away AC power from your requirements for safety, then you can simplify lots of things because you need non-safety diesels. You have so what we do is we have stored power either in batteries or in compressed air or compressed nitrogen, and that actuates the safety systems. And then we rely on things like gravity and heat transfer and condensation and evaporation, which are natural processes, to provide the safety of the plant. What that does for our plant is it takes things that are existing in today's plants, and the list here is long. In today's plants, most of these systems are safety-related. And whenever it's safety-related, it costs more money because you have to have quality assurance, you have to have redundancy, diversity, separation, fireproofing, seismic, all those things. If you make them non-safety related, you just need enough for reliable operation, so some redundancy. So all these things that are in current plants are safety related. We still have in our plant, we still have these things, but they're non-safety related. So the cost and the complexity is less. And one other point, in severe accident scenarios, which these Generation 3 plants, which is what happens when you have a melting of the core. In our case, we keep it in the reactor vessel, and we cool the outside of the reactor vessel with water, which is very nice because it keeps all that radioactivity enclosed. So we started with the utility requirements documents that were developed by EPRI and the industry about 15, 20 years ago. They wrote what they wanted. We followed what they wanted. We made major simplifications. We have a new level of standard in safety, as do the other Generation 3 plants. We have design certification on AP1000 that was official in February of 2006, and we're seeking a revision to that certified design in order to make the job of our customers easier as they get their combined operating licenses. So here's our chairman, Steve Tritch, with the NRC commissioners getting the design certification in the end of December 2005. So what's our market? And one of the comments that might be fairly obvious here as we compete with our competitors is we are all going to be busy. So there's nobody who's going to be out of business here. I mean, so it's all a little bit relative, but there's no one who's going to be out of the market because the demand in the world is going to be sufficient for all of us to have a good business. In our case, we have at the moment 8 contracts, 4 in China with a first plant delivery in 2013, and 2 each at Southern Company and South Carolina Electric and Gas. And we have been selected for the technology for licensing for an additional 8 plants, and then there are some that are in the process of deciding. And you can, it's not our role to make announcements of what our customers' decisions are. So there's a few others that might come into the play. As the others, we're competing with for opportunities in South Africa, the UK, Canada, and those will be awarded to one of us or one of us or one of the other reactor vendors that are around. Here's a picture of the Chinese plant they have. You might note Sanmen and Haiyang. There's six plants there. We've actually sold two of them at each of the sites. So in the future, you might expect that they would or we would help them build more AP1000s there. Here's some pieces of big steel, these forgings that are so hard to get that are being built for the Chinese plants. In the U.S., the market is shown on this slide, and it's hard to keep up with it, and it's hard to keep track of who has officially announced and who hasn't. So this is maybe a little dated, but it shows that 12 plants have been selected for AP1000, and it shows the other vendors, EPR, ESBWR, ABWR, and APWR also. A little bit about cost and safety here, because we're saying that we have some advantages over the existing plants. The top graph there is a graph of core damage frequency. It's a probability. And in this case, we want the probability to be low for core damage frequency. And the little yellow box represents the core damage frequency for the AP1000. And if you compare it to current plants, it's about 100 times different, similar to what Andy suggested. And I would say that for Generation 3 or Generation 3 plus plants, that's kind of expected, that you make a significant improvement in the safety of the plants. So all of the reactor vendors are trying to achieve this kind of a level of safety. On the bottom slide, this may be something that is not quite so universally accepted by the reactor vendors, and this is a comparison between the passive AP1000 plant and an active plant at the same power rating. And you can see that the amount of equipment in piping and concrete and other things is somewhere around half or less than from the existing plant. So the amount of equipment equal cost. I mean, it's hard to compare the cost from something that we did 20 years ago with something that we're going to do 7 years from now or 6 years from now. But the quantities will control the cost. This is a better example of it. The Sizewell plant was built in the U.K. in the late 1990s, 1998. It is a Westinghouse plant, and it is a active four-train evolutionary plant. It's a nice plant. It has an output of 1,200 megawatts, and it's next to it here on the right is the AP1000. These are drawn to scale, and we have an output of 1,100 megawatt plants. So you might think that they would be about the same size, but they're not about the same size. And the colors represent the safety-related power that is needed to provide safety for the plant. And you can see that in Sizewell, you know, it's a very pretty picture. It's got colors everywhere. And then an AP1000, it's not so pretty. It doesn't have so many colors. But this is a little bit like PRA. You know, smaller is better. So size matters, and unlike other situations, smaller is better. So that's a good conclusion. I'll make another little comment about something that happened, some discussion of that happened in the first panel. When you think about how many plants we're going to build by 2030, you have to be realistic about when you're going to build the first one. And that once you decide when you can build the first one, then the concept of building a huge number or a small number or a medium number is clear. So in the United States today, nobody here, nobody can build a plant before 2016. We have signed a contract to build a plant by 2016. So when you say what's going to happen between now and 2030, there's going to be zero plants until 2016, and that'll be the first one. And maybe each of us have a first one in 2016. But you really have to look at what's going to happen between 2016 and 2030 and what's possible. So, thank you.
Thank you, Ed. Lee, you have to bring up the a slightly different reactor design, I believe.
Discussion. Two, actually.
Oh, okay.
Let's see. While I'm doing this, let me say it's a pleasure to have the opportunity to speak here to the Center on Strategic and International Studies. I'm Lee Elder. I'm Senior Vice President. We're all, I guess, Andy's in sales. I'm in sales. Ed's not in sales, right, Ed?
I'm in sales.
Although it feels like a, it feels like a Westinghouse alumni party up here. I spent 20 years working for Westinghouse before leaving and going to GE. Andy worked for me at one point. Ed and I were peers, so it's a pleasure to have the opportunity to be back here with these guys discussing a very important topic. As one of the charter members of USCAP, General Electric Company, all the way up to our chairman, Jeff Immelt, profoundly believe that nuclear power has to be part of any solution for energy security or climate change. At the same time, we also believe, consistent with the remarks from the earlier panel, that nuclear power cannot be the only solution to that. And as such, we, as a company, are investing in a very, very wide, diverse portfolio of energy solutions to address this challenge, of which one, nuclear is one. And through the work of our company, our four global research centers, we are also exploring advanced solutions, not just current solutions, but advanced solutions to these problems. But to return to the theme of nuclear power, we've been in business for 50 years. We have a very proud heritage, and we're proud of the fact that we are now the only U.S.-controlled nuclear supplier left in this country. As you know, the other suppliers have had their businesses sold or acquired by other entities. We did merge our business with Hitachi, nuclear business with Hitachi, last year. We hold the controlling interest and management in that merged company for all areas of the world except for Japan, where we hold a minority interest. Through those 50 years, we've seen the construction of 94 boiling water reactors around the world, 52 built by GE and the remainder built by our licensees, including Toshiba, and even the reactors which now are part of the Areva legacy, all were based on GE boiling water reactor technology. Through that 50 years, our engineers have had one vision in mind around which they've wrapped their collective imagination, and that is that with boiling water reactor technology came the opportunity to continuously simplify the design, and by doing so, to reduce the cost of that design, improve its safety, reduce radiation exposure, and reduce rad waste generation as well. The first BWRs actually looked like and worked like PWRs. They had, in fact, they were even worse. Dresden 1 not only had steam generators and reactor coolant pumps and loops, but also had a steam drum. The first simplification came with the elimination of the steam drum, but the first really major simplification was what occurred between KRB and Oyster Creek, and that is that our engineers discovered how to drive all steam separation internal to the reactor vessel, thereby eliminating the need for steam generators or steam drums. But still, that was a pretty complicated plant. A lot of recirc loops, a lot of recirc piping, pumps, expensive equipment that had to be maintained, inspected frequently. We improved somewhat on that with the evolution of a new design that drove more of the recirculation internal to the reactor vessel, passive component called a jet pump. Still left us with recirc loops, though. The next big evolution came with the advanced boiling water reactor, where we were able to get rid of the recirc loops completely and simply rely upon pumps, integral pumps that are located in the bottom of the reactor vessel. And I'll talk a little more about ABWR. It's a Generation 3 reactor. And now our latest reactor, the one we're developing right now, is ESPWR that eliminates the pumps completely. So you got rid of the loops, steam generators, piping, and the pumps, and relies simply on natural circulation, a phenomenon. Actually, it's kind of a back to the future. The early boiling water reactors operated on natural circulation. One operated in the Netherlands for almost 40 years. So this is not a a new or unproven technology. It's one that that was used early in the program and we're now returning to. What differentiates us to, in addition to some of the things I've already said from the other suppliers of nuclear technologies, we actually have two technologies to offer to the world. One is the advanced boiling water reactor, of which I mentioned earlier, Generation 3. It is operating now. Four ABWRs have been constructed in Japan, are operating. One more is under construction in Japan. Two are under construction in Taiwan. And then we have ESPWR, which is currently has certification underway. And I'll provide a schedule later on that talks about the schedule for deployment, potential schedule for deployment of each of these technologies here in the U.S. The ABWR, as I mentioned, is the only proven operating Generation 3 reactor. It was designed to utility requirements documents and EURD, certified under Part 52. It has lower O&M than existing boiling water reactors, has comparable. The ABWRs in Japan actually have lower radiation exposure and rad waste generation than the pressurized water reactors in Japan, thereby confirming the vision that our engineers had that these things could be accomplished through the simplification of this technology. It also has comparable or lower core damage frequency than either AP1000 or the EPR. And the way that was achieved really, again, comes back to simplification. With the elimination of these large penetrations for recirc loops, we eliminated the potential in a serious accident for water level to drop below the top of the core. In both ABWR and ESPWR, the water level never drops below the top of the core. The fuel never overheats. If you don't overheat fuel, you can't melt fuel. So core damage frequency is, for ABWR, is actually a little better, comparable to it, a little better than the other competing designs. ESPWR, which I'll talk about in a bit, is about 10 times better than that. It's aircraft impact resistant. I'll show you a better design. It is truly the most advanced operating reactor on the planet. It has fully digital INC, completely digital control room, plant-wide fiber optic networks. I had a picture that I took out for the sake of brevity of a control room of an ABWR, but it's astonishing. If you've been to a nuclear plant, you walk into the control room and you can be stunned by the mind-numbing number of alarms, indicator lights, hand switches, thumb wheels. Those have all been replaced in ABWR and will be in the ESPWR with simple CRTs, touch-sensitive CRTs. Two operators can sit at a small panel and operate, start this plant up, operate it, shut it down, and deal with any accident situations. So should an accident occur, the CRT will bring up an illustration of the plant, highlight the area of the plant that's having a difficulty. The operator simply touches that, brings up a larger view of the specific system, highlighting the component that is having difficulty, and over on the right-hand side is a list of the emergency procedures that that operator can take right there from his seat by simply touching the CRT. Again, truly, truly state-of-the-art. This is a cutaway of the plant. Those over here won't be able to see me going over here, but the reactor containment is actually small and inside here. This is the reactor building. The reactor building is designed to be aircraft impact resistant, has a steel liner. But so you've got 3-4 feet of concrete here to stop any impact, but also another 4-5 feet of concrete around the reactor vessel. Control room is below grade, top of core is below grade as well. ESBWR is an evolution of ABWR. We have simply replaced active systems that are there for safety with systems that rely more on natural forces, gravity, natural circulation, and evaporation. We're saying it can be completed in, we're estimating a 36-month construction schedule. By the way, the advanced boiling water reactors in Japan were built in, at Kashiwazaki, were built in 39 and 37 months, respectively. Andy, I think that's about the same period of time since you guys signed a contract in Finland. The
okay, my logic. Yeah. When we get to that point, we used to be friends.
So, it's and it does have improved safety, security, passive designs, and improved outages. The specific attributes. We'll go back one. We start with the spent fuel pool. Is located below gray here and in a building which is designed for aircraft impact resistance. The reactor building, the Kina reactor building, lots of water in an isolation event. Rather than relying on active systems, steam will simply flow from the reactor up through these passive submerged heat exchangers, condense back into the vessel. In the event of a pipe break, steam, again, simply escapes into the containment, up to the pipe, into another passive heat exchanger, and back down into these pools, back into the vessel. It's not borated water, so the effects of having to, if you have a severe, let's face it, you have a severe pipe break, despite your comments, Andy, you're going to have a cleanup. Whether you've got an active safety system or not, you're going to have a lot of work to do to clean up after that event. So, but this water is not borated. The effects of having to deal with cleaning up borated water from other components is one that won't exist with this design. Turbine building, terminal employee, likely a GE turbine. Around the rest of the world, we would look to potentially to GE or Siemens or Alstom. The plant will be designed for all three. Control room is below grade. There's a very simple illustration of that control panel that I mentioned earlier. Like EPR and like AP1000, I think the world is going to build and is already building a lot of these reactors. Four, as I said, are operating in Japan, two more under construction in Taiwan. Shimane 3 is under construction in Japan. Just as Andy has encouraged you to go to Okiloto and view the EPR under construction there, I would certainly welcome you to go to Shimane. It is an astonishing feat and demonstrates the amazing construction capability of ourselves and our partners and our partner Hitachi. And then here in the U.S., Dominion, Entergy, Exelon, and DTE have chosen the ABWR, and there are other utilities with whom we're working for ESBWR and other utilities with whom we are working for ABWR as well here. Licensing status. This one, perhaps a little counterintuitive, shows that ABWR would tend to trail ESBWR. There was a COLA submitted by South Texas Project in 2007. They have chosen a different course and probably resubmit that COLA later this year. These other utilities with whom we are working would be on a schedule should they choose ABWR to submit in 2008, and that would probably leave them in a situation of being having their COLs issued roughly 2012, would support commercial operation potentially 2016, possibly 2017. ESBWR on a slightly faster schedule simply because coal is the initial first COLA was filed last year. You might ask yourself, why would anybody want an ABWR if it takes longer? Some utilities like the fact that it is proven, the fact that there are four operating. All four were constructed, as I said, on schedule, on budget, very short period of time. Others like the attractiveness of the simpler design of ESBWR. I see we have a font issue here. Nuclear plants have to be built differently than they were in the 70s. We know nobody hasn't. We've all seen that movie. Nobody wants to see it again. And we're on track to do that. The plants in the 70s weren't standardized. Engineering began the day the construction, almost essentially the day the plant engineering began. The day the plant was started under construction, the contract was signed. We have a two-step regulatory process. This time around, all three of us, I know, are committed to standardizing the design, having the vast majority of the engineering done beforehand. We have a better licensing process. We as suppliers will commit to fixed quantities and schedule. We are already using advanced computer automated engineering tools that allow us to check for interferences, check for some of the things that drove some of the problems in the construction in the 70s and the 80s. The 3D models that check for interferences and using proven modular construction techniques similar to those that have been demonstrated so successfully for us in Japan. We have a fully qualified supplier. Andy mentioned Areva has had a continuous construction record. We and our partners have had the same. In 50 years, GE and Hitachi have always had at least one nuclear plant under construction somewhere around the world. That's enabled us to maintain this qualified supply chain and support construction going forward. Constraints and challenges, just a couple of thoughts, and I think there's going to be a later session on this. If we think in a global sense, licensing is a challenge. We've got a good process that we all have confidence here in the U.S., but then you go to the U.K. or you go to Finland or you go to anywhere else in the world, and typically country of origin license isn't accepted. You have to go back through another process. It would, and I know the NRC is working with those other regulatory bodies, but having consistent regulatory framework globally would certainly improve the prospects for significant development of nuclear power around the world. Supply chain was mentioned. Large forgings, JSW is the only company in the world right now that can produce ultra-large forgings. We saw that coming, by the way. 4 years ago, we got together with JSW and signed commitments for the number of reservations in their factory to match the number of nuclear plants that we expect to build. That number is supposed to be a secret. I'm not supposed to tell you, but what I can tell you is all the plants that we expect to build, we have room in their factory to support it with these reservations. EPCs, we're all aligned with strong EPC partners, but it's going to be a challenge. Those EPC companies haven't built nuclear plants in the United States, at least in a long time. I believe the engineering capability of those EPC firms is fully up to the challenge of building these plants. I think the availability of labor is potentially a big challenge that we'll have to think about. And then we mentioned earlier, financing policies have to be right to attract capital. And on maybe one of the few points that Tom and I might agree, I happen to think that put the price of carbon at the right level, and that's probably the best thing you can do to encourage the construction of nuclear plants. Create the financial incentive, creates a nice level playing field. I don't necessarily think of loan guarantees, by the way, that's where I'm sure I differ with Tom, as subsidies. Loan guarantees in the United States are no different than what EXIM offers for projects around the world. An associate of mine is fond of saying, why should it be possible for GE or Westinghouse or Areva to build a nuclear plant in Mexico and get the full benefit of U.S. EXIM loan guarantees for that project, but not be able to do the same thing in New Mexico? And so I think the policies have to be right to attract this capital. In summary, hey, the renaissance is already underway. We believe it's going to be global. We are leveraging best practices from the Japan experience. We have the technology to meet industry needs, and we're investing in the people and products to be able to deliver. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Lee. We're running fairly tight on schedule, but we will take a couple of questions if they have some here. Arnie?
Arnie Baker. Arnie Baker, Sandia National Labs. Two quick questions. One, you all are talking about at least gigawatt size reactors in your presentation today. Are any of you are working on smaller reactors, so-called right size reactors, whatever the terminology is? Second question, without revealing any proprietary information, could you give us some sense of what a new nuclear plant would cost? And you can do it in terms of capital, levelized, or bracket, or range. Thank you.
I'll speak first. We are not currently developing a small anything smaller than ABWR, which is 1,350 megawatts. In terms of capital cost, we're estimating ABWR is probably just north of $3,000 a kW, and ESBWR is just south of that number. Again, that to be clear, that number is an overnight number and does not include owner's costs and the cost of the site, yard, intake structures, things like that.
We are working on some right-sized plants. We have the IRIS, which is an integral pressurized water reactor, which is in the 300 megawatt range, and we also are working on the pebble bed high-temperature gas reactor, which is in the 150 megawatt range. And I would say that for overnight costs, we're in about the same range as. And I would make a comment on cost that everybody who publishes a cost number has a different definition of cost. And while we're saying it's 3,000 plus, when Florida says it's whatever 6,000 or 8,000, they're also correct. But they have transmission, inflation, cost of money in their definition of cost. So it's very difficult for people to have an intelligent conversation on cost.
We're here to supply the world in this situation. We're developing a fleet of five units, 600 megawatts, 800, 1,000, 1,200 in the EPR. We already have the 1,450. Our 1,000-megawatt unit we're jointly developing with MHI. It's called ATMIA-1. Our 1,200-megawatt unit is an so-called SWR-1000. It's a boiling water reactor based on Siemens technology. We're looking at nations, for example, like Vietnam, which don't have the infrastructure to support large nuclear units but could support 600 megawatt, 800, or 1,000 megawatt units. And we want to make sure that those people have the non-carbon dioxide and resources available to them. So we are, in fact, actually making those investments. In terms of cost, I would like to say this, that Constellation has selected us for units to supply the PJM grid, that we have been selected by Pennsylvania Power and Light to supply units for the PJM grid. We have been selected by Ameren UE to support the Missouri grid. They are well aware of the forward prices for wholesale electric power, and the only word I could use for those prices that I'm aware of is amazing. Amazing. 2015, $120 a megawatt hour generated, and they find our technology quite competitive and desirable in that environment.
Okay, we're running tight. I understand we're going to lose the room, so one more question if it's quick. So, Tom.
Just a couple. Tom Cochran at NRDC. A couple of corrections. Lee, your two reactors at Kashiwazaki are not operating. They're down for the year along with the other five from the earthquake.
They operate. When did they start up, Tom?
I said they're not operating. What? They're operable, but not operating.
All right.
All right. The Mr. Cook, the problem, you showed a slide of your finished plant, but you didn't point out it's 2 years behind schedule and your company's losing its shirt on that contract.
I want to respond to that because
you can
it's
when
appropriate.
I'm finished,
no,
sir.
It's absolutely appropriate that we are making the investment at our risk now, and the customer, we firm fixed price the plant to get that technology demonstrated and built, have the supply chain in place. So, yes, when you go out on a first-time project, there's going to be problems, and that's why we as a corporation made that investment, and we're doing it at Flamanville so that those plants will be available in production quantities and they will be certain. No one, it would be naive to assume if you're building a brand new tech, new plant, new type of plant, that the first time it's going to come online without some kind of challenges. There will be challenges. There have been. We have backed our customer.
We are demonstrating that plant, and they will be up and running before the U.S. plant so that that technology and the certainty will be there. I'm not ashamed of that situation. I'm very proud of what we're doing.
I'm not ashamed. I'm just trying to get some facts out. You held up a pellet, but you didn't point of LEU, but you didn't point out that if you were mining 0.2% ore, you would have to have 4,000 times as much rock move to get that pellet. So your comparison with coal is not quite accurate. Now, let me finish. Your largest stockholder is the French government, who owns 96% of your stock. The French president, since he was elected in May of 2007, has offered your technology to such authoritarian, non-transparent, in some cases corrupt governments as Morocco, Algeria, Libya, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Georgia. Do you think it's a good idea to sell your technology to those companies before you have safeguards in place that can ensure that we don't have another problem such as in Iran and North Korea?
So let me respond to those two comments, if I may. First of all, as all physicists know, there is a factor of 10 to the 8. That means 100 million times more energy per atom coming out of uranium than out of fossil fuels. That's a fundamental law of nature. We talked about law of nature for the safety systems. That's a law of nature. That means to get the energy out of the ground through uranium, you're mining on the order of a million to 100 million times less material. That's what that means. And Tom was actually somewhat disingenuous in his comment because he knows darn good and well that we have mines in Saskatchewan where the purity of the raw ore is not 0.2%, but is between 60 and 95% uranium. These are amazing geological deposits. We are actually mining them. They are beautiful. They're halfway up Saskatchewan, and the situation he is describing certainly doesn't apply in that case, and he absolutely knows about those situations. As regards to President Sarkozy, it is certainly the case that the French government made the investment in nuclear power because France has basically no indigenous energy resources. It's like Japan and it's like Taiwan. They realized years ago that the alternative was to use nuclear power, and that's what they have done. President Sarkozy is not related to my company. He is doing some very interesting things, and I really can't speak to him, to what his policies are. What I can tell you is that my company is committed to the safe, sustainable implementation of this non-carbon dioxide-emitting technology and to make it available to the world to get through this energy situation that our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren are going to be dealing with. Thank you.
Thanks, Andy. And on the non-proliferation question, we will have a chance to talk about that in greater detail and not necessarily put you on the spot for the policies. But I know there's probably a lot of other questions of this panel. It's been a really informative session, and will you join me in thanking them again for their presentations? Yeah, and we're going to go straight into the last session since we're starting to run tight on time. Okay, why don't we go ahead and we'll move to our last session. One of the points that I think was made as a key factor. Hello. One of the points that was made as a potential key factor in the nuclear renaissance in the United States was the question of public acceptance. And I think this is an issue that floats around, has been floating around nuclear for a long time, nuclear energy for a long time. And there are some who believe that the public really is not willing to accept nuclear, especially in their own neighborhood. So we thought it would be useful to look at some of the polling data that's been drawn up to say, well, what are the attitudes at this point in time. Obviously, attitudes change with the situations that people face. So we're fortunate today to have Sam Rogers from Zogby Polling. That Zogby has just recently done some work updating some energy polling information they've had. And we actually, Sam had a longer presentation, which maybe we'll touch on some of them, which actually, from a broader energy point, gives some great insights to the public reactions. We've asked him to focus today on the reactions on nuclear energy. So, Sam?
Thanks. Thank you. Thanks to CSI. Sorry that John Zogby couldn't be here today. Travel schedule wouldn't allow it, but we've had a long relationship with CSIS. I know that he serves on the your commission for smart power, and that he's enjoyed that very much. I'd also like to just put a disclaimer that these questions weren't sponsored by anyone. These were just internal in-house questions that we asked both just as a communications effort about a month ago, and then after they contacted us, they saw those. I think the Wall Street Journal talked about some of these numbers. We ran some new numbers specifically for this presentation, and so there's no client involved. Just wanted to let you know that. These were all interactive. We have an interactive panel of over 300,000 respondents. This latest poll just came out of the field on Monday. I've also got data from January and June of last year. That was actually done for UPI, United Press International, and all this has been released publicly. So for all this, we're looking at margins of error of around a little over 1%. Just about overall energy use, John likes to talk about how Americans now recognize they live in an age of limits, and I think this is, he highlights this in his new book that comes out, I'll plug it, August, Random House, The Way We'll Be. 64% of Americans think that the U.S. uses too much energy currently, and that's pretty striking, and that's held, you can see, from January of last year on. And moreover, 55% believe that the U.S. government should act to reduce energy use, even if it means significant changes in lifestyle. And so all that to say, and I had a section here on gas prices, and we all know about the impact of gas prices recently. And this is to say that it's causing Americans to reevaluate energy on all levels. 70% have changed their spending habits because of rising gas prices. 47% have already cut their driving. And most of them see that gas prices aren't going anywhere but up in the near future. And so all this brings us to nuclear power. Now, when we ask Americans if they think nuclear power is safe, we get a majority. 69% strongly agree or somewhat agree that nuclear power is safe. And what's noticeable is the 10% increase in those who believe strongly in the fact that nuclear power is safe. And for those of you who have a hard time reading, it's just a good rule of thumb. The bluer, the more positive the number, the redder, the more negative in general, if you can't read the labels at the bottom. And then we asked if the U.S. should build more nuclear power plants to meet future needs. And again, we get a majority. That's 68%, which is up from 62% in January of last year. We asked if they support building one in your community. Now, this was, of the 68% who agree that we should build more nuclear power plants, 69% support building one in their own community. We obviously didn't ask people who disagree with building plants in general because they would have opposed it. Then we asked everyone about storage of nuclear waste, and here you get a lot of confusion. You know, underground sites, 39, production site, 22, not sure, 39. And I think that most people probably don't understand the intricacies of storing nuclear waste and don't really know. And now of those who said, the 39% who said we'd accepted an underground site, 51% said they'd accept it in their state, and only 33% said they wouldn't. So that actually comes to a half of a half, so about a quarter of everyone overall is fine with accepting nuclear waste in their home state. And then we look at what kinds of concerns people have about nuclear power. The four big issues I think that you all have highlighted today, storage of waste is number one, has the greatest concern. That's about 86% are very concerned or somewhat concerned. The second is the safety of the plant's operation itself, which is about 69%, so about two-thirds of Americans have some concerns about the safety there. International security, 63%, very or somewhat. And then the overall cost of nuclear power, we've got 47%. So that about breaks even with those who are concerned and those who aren't. And then we asked how you feel about the safety compared with 30 years ago. 71% think that it's much safer. Only 4% feel that it's less safe. And so that kind of gives you an idea, before I get into this last section here, that Americans are pretty open to the idea, I'd say, of nuclear power. They're reevaluating everything. There doesn't appear to be a lot of objection to it, but they're still concerned, I mean, as evidenced here in this slide. And so then the last thing we did, which was actually the first question, was we asked people to describe nuclear power in one word. What's the first word that comes to your mind? And this was what we got, which was, it's kind of all over the place, and we'll break it out later. Obviously, the largest word there is the one in big dark blue, dangerous, which you've also got efficient, necessary, needed, safe, Chernobyl. There were a lot of people who said Chernobyl because they couldn't put Three Mile Island because it was more than one word. So, this is kind of an idea of just what's going on in people's heads when they think of the word nuclear. And I'll say I was disappointed. When we tested it, the first thing that came to my mind was Homer Simpson. And a colleague of mine and I both put it, and we were the only two people in America, I guess, who think that. I guess, yeah. And so when we look at this, we break it out into those who strongly agree with constructing nuclear power plants. And these are the words that come to their mind. Clean, cheap, efficient, necessary, needed, underutilized, smart solution. I mean, all pretty positive. A very good blend of it. And so this is 44% of Americans who strongly agree with constructing nuclear power plants. That's what's in their head. And then you get the obstacle, which is the 13% who strongly disagree. And these are the words that are going around in their head. It's still that threat, the danger, unsafe, the waste. Kind of just gives you an idea of what people are thinking about. And all this, I guess, to say that, people are open to alternatives. They're open to nuclear power. They're open to anything that doesn't have the word gas in it, I think, at this point. But they're not sure about safety. They're not sure about the disposal of waste. They don't know enough about it. We haven't built a plant in how long? It hasn't been part of the discussion in so long, I think. And there are some interesting subgroup divides. We didn't get into it mainly because we only saw this data first on Tuesday. So we've had less than 48 hours. But there are partisan divides on nuclear power. I'm sure that's not surprising. There's some age divides. Older Americans tend to support it more, probably because they're more familiar with it. There's some gender divides, men over women, Republicans over Democrats, independents, split right in the middle, as usual. That's pretty much the overview of how Americans are feeling about nuclear power these days, and I guess that's about it. And we're open to questions, and if we get cut off and have to evacuate the room, I'll hang out in the hallway for a minute.
Well, I already see hands going up, so take the question in the back there.
Yeah, hi. Paul Jenna with the Nuclear Energy Institute. Great presentation. I was really interested by one of the very first findings, which is, if I understood it right, Americans think we use too much energy, or is it that we waste
too
much energy?
Right, yeah, I can go back to that. If there's any press, then this is the number you should call.
Don't talk to you.
Let's see, what was it? Yeah. Regardless of the type of energy, does the U.S. use too much, the right amount, or not enough? Kind of the Goldilocks question. That's what we call it. And, so you've got 64% say too much and 25% the right amount. So that's pretty much everyone. And it's held the same over the last few years. And your question?
Well, it just points out just a fundamental.
Yeah, there's definitely a realization that, we're in a strange position with energy right now.
Yeah.
We use too much. We don't like where it comes from. We want something else. We don't really know what else we can do.
Okay, thank you.
That's good. Here on the right side and then over on the left for a second.
Hi, Tom Kaufman, also with NEI. You said the words that people use to describe nuclear. Did you say for generally everybody the number one word was dangerous?
Yes. And I don't have an exact percentage on that. I'm sure we could figure that out.
So when you looked at the entire group, the number one word that came up was dangerous. Then right. How did you break it down?
And the number two word is clean. So
the number two word is clean.
Go figure. What's
the number three word? I'm just kidding.
Let's see. It would be, it's done by size. Necessary, needed, and efficient are all right there, tied for three.
But then for the people who are opposed to it, dangerous is number one.
Right, and I think the reason why, the math behind it, almost everyone who strongly disagrees, the first word is dangerous. And so it's much easier to associate a negative word than a positive word. You know, if you don't like nuclear power, you've got that word dangerous right there. To think of a positive word, it's divided between clean, efficient, excellent. You know, I mean, these were the top 50 words. There weren't even 50 words used by people who strongly disagree. So in that sense, the intensity is more geared toward a few words as opposed to spread out over all these different possibilities.
Sean Burns from the Senate Energy Committee. I've seen other studies recently that suggest that the growing support in the public for nuclear energy is driven more by their increased concerns about global warming and dependence on foreign oil than their real perception that nuclear safer now than 30 years ago, but that sounds like you're seeing something different than that. And you're
well, no, I think that's definitely part of it too. You know, I mean, you've got So aside from the current energy situation, you've got the environmental factors that are driving that as well. I mean, it's kind of like the perfect storm of everything that could go right for advocates of alternative energy is going right now. I guess to answer the question. And we've seen that in our data. I don't have any of it here, but definitely the climate change issues and the environment are driving a lot of people, and we've seen that.
Your data does show that people perceive it as safer now than it was 30 years ago.
Right, yeah.
Take another question on this side.
I'm Lubna Rana from the State Department. I was just wondering if you asked any questions that tell you what is informing people's views on nuclear energy, how aware they are. Do they even know if there's a nuclear plant in their community or in their state?
Yeah. That's a good question. To my knowledge, we haven't asked about that. I'd say the people are probably generally unaware to a large degree. I mean, they know nuclear power. They know what a nuclear power plant looks like. Obviously, if there's one nearby, they can probably see it. But they haven't had that kind of, I mean, it really hasn't been part of the debate because there hasn't been construction recently, and people just don't know the ins and outs of it. They just know the word, and like you can see, the first thing, still a lot of people think of Chernobyl. That was 20, however many years ago. And Three Mile Island, you know, those things still stick with them. So their awareness is limited to a few words and maybe a picture in their head of something. but you're right. I think awareness would be low. Yeah. So.
Well, I think we have time for one more question. We'll take it here.
I'm Corey Hinderstein with the Nuclear Threat Initiative. I have two questions. One is on the question about what is scary or what you don't like, waste.
Oh, right.
There was waste disposal, safety, cost.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you ask about international security? I mean, what was the basis? Was it proliferation? I don't know how you ask the question about international security, and I'm curious about how you do that. And then the second question is on dangerous. Was there a follow-up to the name one word, like what is dangerous? I mean, looking at the spray of words, it looked like it focused on toxic, cancer, that dangerous to yourself or your family. I'm wondering if there was any other. There isn't, terrorism, for example, on that list.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's very true. I don't think terrorism made it on here at all, which is kind of surprising. I mean, just the word nuclear. Although we asked nuclear power, specifically about nuclear power, not nuclear power technology, not just nuclear in general. So that would probably explain that. And we didn't follow up.
See, the plant operators, they all put, two out of three put an airplane scenario on a slide that they felt it was important to communicate. So.
Mm. In terms of your other question about how exactly we phrased the concern, read it off for you. Got it here somewhere. The impact of nuclear power technology on international security. Simply that. How would you rate your concern? And then we gave them those four statements. So the impact of the technology on international security. That's how that was phrased.
Well, Sam, I want to thank you very much. I think this has been really a great set of insights into the thinking. I was going to mention that Homer Simpson probably didn't make it because it's two words. So that
that's true too. Well, otherwise, I just stuck with the Simpsons.
That's right. Okay, well, that's true. That would have been another way.
That's a good point.
And I want to thank all of our speakers, many of whom have, I think, left, but some are still here. I think this is an excellent opening session to give an overview of different aspects of the nuclear power question, and what we'll want to do now is try to drill down a little bit on some of the questions, or quite a bit, hopefully, in the future sessions that have come up today. So you'll be getting notices soon, and thank you all for attending today.